This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 12th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 314 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On the programme today, we'll learn the story of how music became free, for better or worse, with Stephen Witt, whose new book looks at how technology and music collided in the late 1990s to reshape an industry, whether that industry was ready or not.
We'll also be meeting another Stephen Dring, co-founder of Growing Underground, a new project that's turning London's disused underground spaces, bomb shelters and railway lines among them, into farms. He'll be here a little later on.
And we'll also be talking to Tim Marshall, the veteran foreign affairs journalist. He'll be a familiar voice to regular Monocle 24 listeners, but he's here today with his author's hat on to put world affairs on the map and to tell us how maps themselves shape the world's biggest stories.
That's all coming up, plus dreamy Daniel Jacopelli will be pulling into Studio One in his pink current affairs Cadillac, really who writes this, for the news look ahead, and we'll have time for some music too, all right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Pink current affairs Cadillac, was that your work there, Tom?
Certainly was not. It may be another Tom.
Deary me.
He'll have to take responsibility for that later.
He'll be coming up a little bit later. He's doing the news look ahead because you're in Andrew's
seat. And the tables are turned.
And I'm in Rob's seat.
Yeah, Andrew and Rob away. And so, amongst other delights that we've had over the last 7 days, Steve, lots of radio.
Yeah.
And the Monocle Weekly, though I love being in the weekly chair. Sunday lunchtime.
It's a nice place to be. And it's nice to be back in the weekly chair while Rob and Andrew are away. Rob is in New York, currently recording two episodes of The Big Interview. And Andrew's just on holiday.
Hard-earned.
Yeah, it is hard-earned. It is hard-earned. Because, you know, he had been working very, very hard recently, particularly on The Escapist, our new journal, which is coming out very soon and landed in Midori House for us earlier this week.
It's like a little ray of sunshine, Steve, isn't it?
It's very bright yellow. Is that what you're trying to say?
Partly. It looks summery. It embodies the summer, I don't know, essence. As does our July-August issue, to be fair, of the magazine.
But that does
too.
It's
even more sunny than that, those of you who've already got your hands on that.
The Escapist, for those who haven't come across it yet, it's like the forecast that we had at the end of last year, but it's a sort of a travelly, summery, relaxing
summer
read.
Reader, maybe almost.
A summer reader.
It's a beautiful, it's a thing of beauty. But it has, this week, meant that there's been a lot more radio, and that's been a good thing. And Radio 2 has new releases and launches, Steve. The new Monocle 24 radio app. It's out now.
It is out
now. Get amongst it. It's new, improved, so, you know, regular.
I've downloaded it.
Absolutely. Everyone must do the same.
Indeed. It's available at the App Store, which is apparently is like a shop, but one you find on your phone.
Steve, you sound like you're about 700 years old the way you said that.
Can I just point out, by the way, talking about people and technology sounding 700 years old.
Okay, where's this going?
You got a new laptop this week.
Yeah.
And you struggled with it.
Yes.
And Tom Reynolds, who works on our desk upstairs,
he's kind of like a janitor.
Had to teach you how to use your laptop in the way that a son teaches their father how to use new technology. You were struggling with it somewhat.
More like grandson teaches grandfather, I'd say.
It was a little bit.
Was it when I said, where does the blue rope go in? Is that when I lost the...
Yeah, when you were referring to the Ethernet cable, which gives you the internet.
Blue rope.
You know, the magic internet box thing. Yeah, there we are.
It's the devil's work, Steve. Let's move on. Let's
let's
hear from Monocle 24's own little devil.
I hear the purring of a pink Cadillac. Here he is. It's Danny.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
Everything about that track, about the visual image of Danny in his pink Cadillac of news is upsetting, frankly. So let's get to it. Danny, what have you got for us? What's next week's news today?
Well, should we be a bit serious this week?
Yeah, let's try and be a bit serious.
No, we're not going to be serious at all, are we?
Okay,
I'll be a bit serious. So, presidential election in Burundi on the 15th. That's pretty serious, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've been covering that all the past couple weeks on Monocle 24. The the protests there. If no candidate wins, though, there's going to be a second round.
I think
on
that
the 27th.
There's no chance that no candidate will win because Pierre Nkurunziza is without doubt going to win since he's sort of slightly finagled the constitution to allow him to run for a third time, a third term. Third time as well, but
indeed,
you know, third term. And we should indeed keep our eyes on East Africa, Danny, should we not, over the next couple of years, because he's not going to be the only one who's going to go for a third term. I would wager.
Are you saying giving
money.
My vast experience in East Africa?
I'm telling you what.
Okay.
I would wager a certain amount of money that Paul Kagame in Rwanda will find a way to similarly shift his constitution by 2017 to
the
allow
story
him
of Paul
to run
Kagame him. Is incredible, how he kind of started off people thinking he was going to be like the super pro business reformer, and he slowly descended into a.
Well, if you look at all the African presidents that Bill Clinton sort of fated in the late 90s as this sort of new African renaissance, there was Kagame, there was Yoweri Museveni in Uganda, there was Meles Zenawi, who recently died, in Ethiopia, Isaias Afwerki in Eritrea. These were the guys that Clinton was like, he's a new guard. And all of them turned into people that. Well, aside from Meles Zenawi, who died in office, are still in office and aren't going anytime soon. There
and
we
they
are.
Just said, well, look, Bill Clinton said we were doing such a great job that we decided to just stick around for
until Hillary Clinton becomes
yeah, exactly.
president.
That's interesting stuff, Danny. Where should we go next?
Well, the 17th, it's the first anniversary of the Malaysia Airlines disaster over Ukraine. MH17, 1 year ago, if you could believe it, possibly.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah.
Still nobody really, well, we do know what happened.
Well, we do know what happened, but Russia won't admit.
Exactly. Little green men shot it out of the sky.
Indeed. And there'll be all sorts of shenanigans, I'm sure, going on at the UN Security Council, referring to the investigation, which, frankly, hasn't really happened. I mean, it was a shocking story, even just in terms of how the Dutch investigators and the people from the OECD tried to get to the site and couldn't even get to the site.
Yeah, it took quite a while for people to get to the site.
Well, even now, a year on, there's no agreement about how the actual inquiries and investigations are going to proceed, so the chances of getting any proper closure on it, any actual...
I think one certain government doesn't really want closure on that.
Well, quite. No. Exactly.
No, indeed.
No, that's going to run and run. Where to next time?
A day later, fascinating and very optimistic and great story. The Ku Klux Klan is having a pro-Confederate flag rally in South Carolina, as if it's 1960 or 1860. The Loyal White Knights chapter is having a big rally.
I mean, I guess
we could cover that. We'll send maybe an intern there to go see how it's working out.
I guess in some ways, at least it is the Ku Klux Klan that's doing it. So at least draws attention to the fact that it is, no offense to any of your fellow Americans who are maybe a little bit more partial to the Confederate flag than normal people are. It is really only racists that care about that flag.
Yeah, well.
It's kind of one of the things you wouldn't really want.
That's a charge statement.
I don't know if you really want the KKK rallying around an issue that you cared about. It's not going to paint it in the best light, is it?
No, of course not. I mean, but people who support the flag obviously would not say that they're racist, right?
No,
I mean,
it's
not people. It's not like the swastika or something.
They wouldn't
it's people
say
saying
they're
it's
racist.
Southern heritage, which is obviously a load of BS too, because it. But that we don't have time to discuss the causes of the Civil War.
What was interesting, though, about the whole, you know, when it flies outside certain state or, you know, buildings and this sort of thing, was and people cited these traditions and the principles that you mentioned there. A lot of times the Confederate flag didn't fly until much, much more recently than that, into the 50s, 60s even.
Indeed.
So the idea that it's some ancient thing and it's out of, you know, before the war and all this kind of thing is an utter nonsense.
Yeah, it is indeed. It is indeed. Is that enough serious stuff? Well, maybe a bit more serious.
No.
It's light and shade, Danny.
You've got a bit light.
Okay.
Let's end on something light.
What's today? Today's the 12th, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Miss USA pageant is today in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
That's not light. That's shady.
The contestants are judged in three categories.
Oh, God, really?
Swimsuit, evening gown, and interview.
I thought these had all been banned along with Donald Trump.
You know I bring this up every year.
Got rid of the whole thing.
No, not at all. It's a huge, huge industry in the US.
Is it on TV still?
Yeah. Yeah, of course it is.
Oh, really?
Dear. Do you want to? Are you asking because you want to know the exact channel and the time?
I'm just.
Really?
I'm just
how
staggered.
Can I watch that in the UK?
I'm just absolutely staggered that that's still a thing.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. A quite cool event that we should actually cover is the World Rubik's Cube Championship in Sao Paulo. That could be fun. That's happening on the 17th.
Although I do wonder with those things because can't the best people do it in like 2 seconds?
Is it actually that entertaining?
I actually know a little bit about this.
Do you?
Yeah, so...
Tell us, Tom.
Did you have one when you were a kid?
I'm not... Yeah, and I took all the little things off and just re-stuck them on because I got so frustrated.
The hidden history of Tom.
It's done by an aggregate. So I think you have five goes. Your fastest and slowest efforts are taken out. And then your three remaining ones are averaged. So quite often you'll have someone who does it in breakneck speed, 4 seconds, but it's like a freak. Generally speaking, okay. Your aggregate time is what's the driver.
In the world leagues, you're saying?
In this event. So I think last year's winner, his average time was under 9 seconds.
That's incredible.
And the time, practically this time it would take Usain Bolt to dash his 100 metres.
And they could do it with their eyes closed, can't they?
It's all just like muscle memory, yeah.
Algorithms and stuff. But we're just throwing out words that we really don't understand.
It's quite an exhausting and exhaustive process.
Okay, well there we are. I think that's a decent place to end.
Yeah, okay.
Danny Jacopelli, I believe someone's waving to you from your pink Cadillac of news. Tom Hall is in it. He's riding shotgun.
Olivia Newton-John is coming to get me.
He wants a lift home. Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Daniel Jacopelli.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokiosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらはモノクル24です。
Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
For a little while back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, as technology took leaps and bounds that many industries such as the entertainment business were just not prepared for, the question of how we obtain music, films, and yes, even our cherished daily news hit became a bit of a grey area. Things have changed since then. Paywalls have gone up. Apple has mastered the art of selling the MP3, and the general basic premise for any successful business that things have to be paid for is being more respected. We're happy to say.
In the case of music, an industry that truly imploded when it turned out teenagers could download entire back catalogues for free because nobody had yet told them that they couldn't, the story of how that situation came to be was no accident. In his new book, How Music Got Free, US author Stephen Witt has traced the tale back to three, in some cases unwitting protagonists, Karlheinz Brandenburg, a German scientist, Doug Morris, a record company big shot, and Benny Liddell Del Glover, a worker in a CD pressing plant. In telling their story, Witt's book asks a larger question: what happens when a whole generation commits the same crime? And he's here to tell us now. Stephen, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Let me start with that point, actually, about committing a crime, because you start the book, the intro, by saying, you know, you were in the vanguard of this sort of music piracy movement. Where do you stand on that idea of it, of the sort of the criminality of it? Because you almost talk about it as if it was a sort of a lifestyle thing, something to join. Did you consider it that way at the time?
Absolutely. When I first started, it really didn't feel like I was doing anything wrong at all. You know, this was a college campus in the late 90s, and suddenly for the first time, everyone was sort of going online, and they had computers in the dorm rooms, really, really for the first time. So I showed up at school with one of those big old beige box IBM PC clones with a weighed about 20 pounds, and it had a 2 gigabyte hard drive. That's about 1/30th the size of your phone right now. But at the time, it was massive. And, you know, sort of hanging around the chat channel underworld over the course of the next 6 months or so, I built an enormous collection of pirated files. And I did so for the next 10 years. At the time, I didn't think I was a pirate. That word, it wasn't something I would have used for the first 4 or 5 years. It wasn't until later, until law enforcement and civil lawsuits from the industry really started to force these guys out of business, that I began to realize, hey, there's some segment of society that thinks this is really morally wrong. But it never felt that way when you first started doing it.
And what's interesting is that, you know, many of those initial pirates, they weren't doing this for money, were they? They weren't then selling what they'd ripped. They were giving away for free, and it was about being the first to discover the great new thing.
They were doing it for thrills, I think, and to fill a technological vacuum that the industries would not. The earliest pirates got a hold of this guy Brandenburg's MP3 encoder, cracked the copyright protection on it, and started ripping music files in 1996. And at the time, bandwidth was so slow that they actually would code these to floppy disk and then send them through the mail. So that's sort of how this started. And that was a great expense to themselves. As you say, they weren't selling these things. They were trading them with friends, often, you know, paying out of pocket to buy the equipment to do it. So, you know, it was more a hobbyist kind of thing. It was more a subculture of people who'd figured out how to do this and were fascinated by the technology than sort of your classic model of organized crime.
Now, you mentioned Karlheinz Brandenburg there, and obviously his story is sort of one of those key strands that are sort of tied together, that sort of drive the narrative of the book. Why did you decide to tell the story in this way? You've got him, you've got Doug Morris. I mean, the details are great of this sort of rise and fall and rise of some of these characters. So I can see from a narrative viewpoint, why did you decide that it worked so well to sort of intermesh those stories in that way?
Each of them, I think, was trying to make money off sort of new technology in a variety of bewildering ways. Each of them at different times failed and succeeded. And I found that to be really fascinating. The other thing is the three main characters in the book are so different from one another. You know, Karlheinz is really kind of this brilliant German engineer, real mathematics whiz, PhD, etc., a genius, actually, in some ways. Morris is the business guy, the classic schmoozer who sort of fixes relationships with egotistical artists and then tells them to go put more hits on their albums. And then Glover was just a factory worker, you know, in a small town in North Carolina, really kind of a disenfranchised person. Each of them, though, in their own way, was able to make a really significant contribution to not just the music industry, but actually the history of the internet. And so I felt by contrasting how each of these guys sort of had a different understanding of the world, you could sort of get to one central thing. Brandenburg understood the technology, but not the business side of it. Morris understood the business side of it, but not really the technology. And, you know, Glover understood both, but not the law.
Let's talk a bit about Del Glover, because as you say, he worked in a factory where they pressed CDs, and he realized that security wasn't great, that he could essentially sort of take CDs out of the factory, you know, that weren't going to be on the shelves for 2, 3, 4 weeks ahead of time. Tell us about how he got involved in this and his part in the story.
Once the pirates had sort of moved away from the floppy disk to the internet, Del Glover sort of got connected with them. He also hung around in these chat channel underworlds just as a hobby on the side, even though his day job was working a packaging line at a compact disk manufacturing plant in rural North Carolina. Very quickly, he realized that he was in a very sort of privileged position. The hottest music of the year was literally at his fingertips weeks and months before it was due in stores. So these guys online sort of tipped him off and let him know, you know, the stuff that you have there in the plant, it's so valuable to us. You should join this sort of worldwide music leaking conspiracy that we're building. And he did. For about 7 years there, he leaked 2,000 albums out of the plant, comprising most of the major hits of the era. So Eminem, Jay-Z, 50 Cent, Kanye West, all of their debuts, their second albums, their third albums, he got them out. After smuggling them, he would bring them home and rip them to the MP3 format using Brandenburg's technology, and then upload that to this cabal of music leakers. From there, very quickly, it would percolate through file sharing services like Napster and Kazaa, if anyone remembers those, and also the torrent sites. And within hours, it'd be available on iPods and hard drives around the globe.
And it's interesting as well that as easy as it was for him at the beginning to steal these CDs, the record companies quickly worked out, didn't they, that they had a leak coming from somewhere, and it became a little harder to get stuff out.
It became a cat and mouse game, really. Universal, which owned the plant, you know, they knew how valuable this inventory was, and they took precautions to prevent it getting out. They put in one of those turnstiles, sort of similar to what you would get at a customs weigh station, and every employee who exited the plant had to swipe an identification card through the turnstile. Maybe 4 out of 5 times they get a green light and they'd be waved through. But 1 out of 5, they get the red light and they'd have to go over and stand in the corner as a security guard took a metal detecting wand and searched their body for that thin aluminum plate that's inside a compact disc. And a number of people were caught this way, actually, smuggling stuff out of the plant. But what Glover eventually noticed was that everybody was this is a small town in North Carolina. Everybody was wearing these big metal belt buckles that would have sort of elaborate decorations on them. And those would always set off this metal detecting wand. But the guards never actually made you take the belt off. So in this way, he and his confederates realized they could stuff the disc sort of behind their belt buckles as they were leaving the plant. And even if they got flagged by security, they could still get them out. And so over the course of 8 or 9 years, that's how thousands of albums got out of the plant. Now, there were more elaborate approaches as well. One of the guys would bring in a cylindrical bowl for his lunch, so maybe like a bowl of noodles or whatever. He'd go in the break room, boil it up, eat his lunch, and afterwards he'd take that bowl in the bathroom and clean it out, wash it out in the sink. Then he'd take 8 or 9 discs at a time and stuff them into the bowl, and with a glue stick, seal the thing back shut so that when he went through security, he could just say, oh, well, I haven't eaten my lunch today. So the employees at this plant were sort of ingenious at devising methods for getting stuff out. And all of it ended up on the internet very quickly.
Let's talk a little bit about then this sort of the change, I guess. I mean, it's also new, relatively speaking, over just, you know, a couple of decades, really. But that shift then where, you know, law enforcement, other people, certainly music industry executives, start to say, well, look, hang on, there's some malfeasance here. This is a criminal enterprise in some respects. What did that do to these originators? Because we mentioned that they weren't necessarily motivated by gain. Did it change their attitude? Or by that point, had it become a sort of almost a crusading idea to share and disseminate this material?
It started out with thrill-seeking teenage boys. But as time went on, law enforcement began to really pay attention. As you said, these guys had the FBI after them. They had European anti-piracy investigators, internal private detectives that the recording industry had hired. All of these guys were trying to break into these music leaking rings. So the rings started almost very innocently, as you said. It was really teenagers in their parents' basements, literally often. But by the mid-2000s, they looked more like sort of a classic model of organized crime, closer to the Silk Road or something, like a predecessor for that. They existed entirely in chat channels. There was a culture of anonymity. You weren't supposed to know anyone else's name, and it was all encrypted. This actually made them very hard to break. The classic model of organized crime, say the mafia, they all know each other. Often they're literally part of the same family, or, you know, they all did time together, or they're from the same neighborhood. But the online model of organized crime is the exact opposite. Frequently, none of the participants know anything about one another, and they're not supposed to. This actually makes them very hard to flip, because if the FBI does eventually catch somebody and they turn him and get him to testify, there's not that much he can tell them. He can just tell them a bunch of screen names in a chat room. And so this made Rabid Neurosis, the group that Glover was part of, very hard to crack. It went on for years, 10 or more years, and leaked 25,000 albums.
How do you feel morally about what they did now? Because you say you got involved in it yourself when, you know, it was seen as a great innocent thing, something to do for thrills. Do you believe now that actually what they were doing was wrong? They were taking something that people had made and giving it away for free.
What Dell was doing was wrong. You know, smuggling, you know, goods from your employer and selling them online, not selling them, but posting them online is, you know, it's bad. It's bad to leak from inside the studio. I think more broadly, the distribution networks that were built by the file sharers, I don't think were morally wrong. Often they weren't built for profit. They were built for the sort of utopian communal ethos of files.
Yeah, but you say utopian ethos. Yeah. We work at a magazine here.
Sure.
If someone was to steal our magazine from the factory in Dorset and put it all online and give it away before we get a chance to sell it, yeah, then this company goes bust and 150 people lose their jobs.
Sure. I think, you know, at the time, the people who did that didn't think that way. They believed that information was supposed to be disseminated in kind of a utopian fashion. I don't think they did think much about what the costs of the producers were. Or if they did, and particularly this is true of the music industry, they actually hated them. I think a lot of the pirates felt that the music industry was bloated and fat, and they were sort of doing a service to humanity by extracting those profits away from them. But it's true. You can't produce anything of value if you can't sell it. Or not. It's very hard to do so anyway. So that's the other side of it.
And what about the sort of the corporate impact more broadly then? You obviously chart how some of these key executives began to engage with this notion of MP3s and that streaming, and that would be the way that people would consume their media. And obviously it necessarily changed their strategy because these technologies were new and different. Do you think it changed the mindset? Did it actually adjust this, you know, this bloatedness, this attitude that maybe was prevalent within the record business?
Here was the fundamental error that they made, and they made it for 10 years before they figured it out. In 1997, Karlheinz Brandenburg, the inventor of the MP3, approached the recording industry and said, listen, you guys got to get ahead of this. This was 2.5 years before Napster. So they had fair warning in advance saying there's this new technology. It can do this. You guys absolutely have to start embracing it immediately. And they refused. They said, sorry, we're just not interested in digital music distribution. Now, what they didn't realize is they'd already been doing digital music distribution since 1982 with the invention of the compact disc. Here's the shift in the mindset that it took them a very long time to make. To the recording executives, to the musicians, to the labels, to the retailers, those racks of CDs at the mall, they looked like inventory. You know, inventory to be sold. But to a computer scientist, they just looked like an array of inefficiently stored data. and that should be centralized and distributed in a much more efficient way. It took them 10 years to come around to that way of thinking, and they didn't really get there until they started to embrace Spotify and new streaming services of this type in the late 2000s.
I want to talk a little bit about the police operation, the FBI operation, to crack down on these people, and particularly the group that Del Glover was involved in, because it was an enormous operation.
Yeah.
Cost huge amounts of money, and yet, without wishing to give too much away, even when people are caught and plead guilty, they're getting like 3 months.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astonishing when you look at the amount of effort and amount of money that goes into catching these guys, and then when they hold down, they go, yep, you got me. Yeah. I mean, they're inside for a number of weeks.
The scope of the conspiracy really was immense. It was worldwide. They had guys in Japan who were sort of exploiting offset international release dates for music. They had music journalists in the UK who were leaking stuff, getting advance review copies for their magazines and leaking stuff out. Guys, radio DJs, and guys within the industry and the promotions businesses. So they had guys sort of all over the world in every major label and most of the indies besides. And when the FBI caught up to them, you know, they would take them to trial. They would go for these, try and get these max sentences, 5 years or more. And remarkably, juries just did not want to throw these guys in jail. You know, even when they were found guilty, they got very limited sentences. Now, part of that was almost all of them cooperated with law enforcement, so they got sentencing leniency. But even then, you know, it is quite remarkable how lenient the sentences were.
Stephen Witt, thank you very much for joining us. The book is called How Music Got Free, and it's out now.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
Steve, all that chat about music, I think we should hear some, shall we?
Yes, let's.
Let's do it. Pirated or otherwise. Everyone loves
Hopefully
it. Everyone
not
loves,
pirated.
Everyone loves a good tune. We've been hearing about leaked albums and industry shaken to its core, but let's get a new release. And this has come, Steve, I assure you, through legitimate channels.
Good.
This is Los Angeles funk experimentalist Thundercat with the suitably titled Them Changes.
That was a very smooth sound, I think you'd agree, Tom Edwards.
It was as smooth as you like, Steve.
Indeed, of LA's Thundercats with Them Changes.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our robust new, upgraded and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today. Stick on your headphones and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Land in London comes at a premium, but what if you could begin a business in an area that everyone forgot even existed? That was the thinking from the minds behind Growing Underground, a new project by entrepreneurs Stephen Dring and Richard Ballard that's using disused spaces such as a cavernous abandoned Second World War bomb shelter as locations to grow food.
Growing Underground grows fresh produce using hydroponic and LED technology that can reach London's tables within 4 hours of being picked, thanks to its conveniently central location 100 feet below the Northern Line in Clapham, South London. The space was originally built as a shelter to house 8,000 Londoners from bombing raids during World War II, and today Growing Underground's produce has already attracted one high-profile fan, Michelin-starred chef Michel Roux, who was so won over, he recently joined the company. Joining us now to tell us more is its co-founder, Stephen Dring. Stephen, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little more about this space, because obviously we've described it in a few words there, but what does it actually look like? What does it feel like, sound like, I don't know, smell like? Paint the picture for us.
Yes, it's quite strange. The first time you go down there, there's stalactites. It's not been well looked after. It's been empty since 1946. So once the war had ended, and so yeah, you go down, you descend 100 feet under London, and you find yourself just with this whole cavernous space. So that we have two tunnels, two linear tunnels. One would have been the northbound and the southbound carriageway on the tube, had they have turned it into a tube, but they didn't. They left it empty, and yeah, it's not the most welcoming environment.
How did you first find it, and what was, were you looking for a site like it?
Me and my business partner had looked at urban farming and looked at vertical farming, and then it was a case of, look, this doesn't stack up financially by doing it in an office block. So Richard, my business partner, knew of these underground spaces, and it was just a case of, okay, does this stack up? We know we can grow in an office block, so we knew we could grow indoors. It was, can we grow without any light whatsoever by using LEDs and hydroponics? So we went down there, went to Transport for London, who control all the empty tubes and tunnels under London. And yeah, they gave us the keys, bizarrely.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, because presumably they get approached, I imagine, from time to time from various,
you know,
entrepreneurs. Yeah. And you won't imagine nightclubs, bars, this sort of thing. Do you think that they were just, you know, taken with the idea? Because it does sound like they were engaged quite, I don't know, seemingly quite easily almost.
Very commercially minded. And yeah, they totally understood exactly what we were trying to achieve straight from the start. There weren't many other takers for a sort of an empty quarter of a kilometre long tubes under the under London. And so, yeah, they explored the idea with us very early on. And then we said, look, we're a startup business. We don't want to sign a long, big, long lease with you. And they gave us the keys just to crack on and test. So that's what we did for a 2-year period, proved that we could do it, and then scaled it up to investors, raised about £750,000, and then went and built the farm that we now see today.
And of course, we're in a city which has a history of using whatever space it can to grow food, however it can. How does that fit in, your project fit in with the sort of the history of London and its use of space?
Well, you look at London, look at the names around London, most of the street names, or certainly lots of the street names around the city, are named after, whether it's poultry in the city or whatever, are named after the markets that were there originally. I think you can still drive geese across Tower Bridge at certain times of the year if you're allowed, or if you're so minded. But yeah, it's part of what is now becoming an integrated food system. We've got growing populations globally, we've got challenges on food production, we've got smaller sort of land mass in terms of agricultural land for us to grow on. And so it's just a case of, can we regenerate urban spaces to actually create food and get it, obviously the proximity to the markets, then getting it to the customers whilst it's still fresh and tasting its best.
Well, we mentioned, Stephen, in the introduction that, you know, within 4 hours from, you know, from your facility to the table, how does that actually happen? Has it been a question of winning over certain distributors, suppliers? Was it a question of finding people like Michelle Roux, who are a bit, little maybe a little more enlightened, a bit more interested in provenance of food that's maybe not traditionally grown? How did you actually go about securing the networks to actually get this produce out there?
I think originally, talking to the likes of, for Michelle as an example, you would expect a 2-Michelin-star chef with a provenance of his background in terms of food. Yeah, Michelle kind of understands where food comes from. I expected him to say, unless it's grown in the sun in the soil in France, I'm not interested. But he understands this is modern food production. And lots of our produce has grown this way already in this country. So he understood it. But that's just one end of the market. That's a high-end micro-herb that's sort of specific, that we've seen at that top end of the sort of restaurant market. However, we grow sort of baby leaf spinach, pea shoots, things that are much more ubiquitous and more generally available. But inevitably, Michelle sort of helps from a PR angle as well, and also helps and sort of just give it that credibility in terms of provenance. People see tubes, and you're down there every day yourself, I'm sure, and you see the tubes, and they're dirty and they're dusty, and they've got mice and rats, and people think, well, how can you be growing sort of food in this environment? Inevitably, what we have is something completely separate from the tube network that doesn't have all the grease and dust and everything, and that we've turned into almost lab conditions to grow using LED lights and hydroponics. So the provenance is there from Michelle, but it does go to a wider market than just that high-end sort of restaurant market.
Do you think that there is something here that can be scaled up and recreated elsewhere, or is this a specific London solution to a London problem?
Urban farming is generally sort of growing across the globe, whether you see in New York, whether you see in Sydney, whether you see in lots of different conurbations. There's lots of challenges around food production globally, as we all know. I don't need to kind of spell those out. But when you look at places like the United Arab Emirates, where you've been massive importers of food because it's actually too hot to grow anything. When you look at places like India, where you've got huge population challenges sort of feeding that population, then yeah, there is an opportunity to take hydroponic and LED food production and put that anywhere, whether it's a sort of abandoned mine somewhere or whether it's in the middle of a desert in a tunnel. It's certainly possible, and we've proven it to be possible. So it is allowing us to increase food production other than just using traditional agricultural land. And if you look at China as an example, years and years and years of using sort of, fertilizers that are probably not best for human consumption. And now I think it's a ridiculous percentage of land, agricultural land in China, is not good for farming. So they're really embracing hydroponic growing. The Japanese are already doing this because they've got sort of restrictions on land space. So there is global intentions for this industry, and it is just a very embryonic industry at this stage. But it's always going to be there to complement farming. It's never going to replace traditional farming, but it's to take the pressure off. Why grow salad leaves and microherbs out in polytunnels on the outskirts of, in land in sort of Norfolk or Cambridge, when we can be producing that stuff quite easily in London and closer to the markets and keeping it fresher, and use that land for whether it's if we continue carry on with population growth and carnivorous diets, then we can use it for cattle, or we could be using it for things like carrots, potatoes, when we could be doing the stuff that biodegrades a lot quicker, we can do that closer to the consumer.
Stephen, tell us a little bit about the actual day-to-day then, down in the sort of growing underground facility. We obviously, so there's the lights there, there's the hydroponic system. What's the sort of hands-on, you know, what is the farming, the kind of, I don't know, husbandry? What does that actually look like? What's the day-to-day?
I leave that to far cleverer people than myself. but no, I obviously have been getting involved in that for a few years and do get involved in overseeing elements of it. But once it's planted, then there's very little to do just to make sure everything's sort of growing as it should be. But the involvement in the interaction is that those daily checks and just ensure it like any grower. And it's just making sure that we are getting the yields that we expect to get for a certain area so we can fulfill our customers' requirements.
And what are those yields? What are you growing? How much?
It's a really tough question because when sort of one herb will weigh a great deal different from another. So, and I can grow some a lot quicker than I can grow others. But if you take pea shoots as a quite a dense, heavy product, for example, if we grew pea shoots and grew pea shoots only in the space that we have at the moment, that'd be about 20,000 kilos a year. So, and we'll probably times that by five or six by the time we finished expanding into the tunnel area where we are at the moment. And then we've got a secondary tunnel network that we've already signed a lease on. So
before long, you're going to have your own tube network of tunnels where
I was going to say, is
your own pea shoots across.
Can you get around more easily? Is it connected into the rest of the underground network?
I've asked my own, platform 9.5 or whatever it is, but I'm not getting one, no.
Okay, well, good luck with trying to get one of those in the future. Stephen Dring from Growing Underground, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
New York City lives up to its movie star good looks and is a city that surprises too. The Monocle Travel Guide to New York, published by Gestalten, is a celebration of all that we love about this ever-evolving city.
New York is both industrial and industrious. You can see everything from Art Deco to Beaux-Arts edifices. But we're fans of little design details too. The hidden rooftops, neon signs, wooden benches, water containers, and fonts that get well below the surface of the metropolis.
Monocle Films samples some of the best places and experiences the city has to offer, and our cinematic portrait is now playing in the film section of monocle.com.
Tim Marshall is a name that many Monocle 24 listeners will be familiar with. Tune in to our daily discussion programme, Midori House, and you might be lucky enough to hear him putting some of the world's most complex stories into context. As a journalist over the course of 20 years at Sky News, Tim filled roles that included Middle East correspondent and diplomatic editor, and has reported from 12 different war zones. In his own words, he's been shot with bird pellet in Cairo, bruised by police in Tehran, arrested by Serbian intelligence, detained in Damascus, declared persona non grata in Croatia, strange one, bombed by the RAF in Belgrade, and tear gassed all over the world. Tim runs thewhatandthewhy.com, a site dedicated to adding clarity to the global news agenda.
So who better to cast an eye over some of the world's most challenging geopolitical issues and to try and make sense of the lie of the land? That's what Tim's latest book is trying to do. Prisoners of Geography looks at how maps, borders and the boundaries that man creates himself make the world a very complicated place. And he's here now to tell us more. Tim, great to have you with us. as always.
Thank you. There is no way I can live up to that introduction, but I will attempt to.
It was pretty good. It was pretty detailed.
Yeah, who wrote that?
Tell me, your book is subtitled 10 Maps That Tell You Everything You Need to Know About Global Politics. Is that true? If you look in maps, something that a lot of people find very compelling, are there all the answers contained therein?
Everything is a flexible word. I do think that without looking at the maps, the rest of it, which is the words you read, and often what you hear on the radio and the news bulletins you watch on television, they are missing that vital ingredient. An example is the Alawites of Syria. President Assad is an Alawite. They came out of the mountains, out of the hills, above the coastal plain on the Mediterranean of Syria. That's interesting historical fact. When you look at a map of the fighting in Syria, especially recently, and you see there's a pattern emerging, and in that pattern you can see they're desperate to keep the motorway open between Damascus and Homs, and then a left turn back up to those mountains. And that is contextual when you know their origins. They're making sure they've got a corridor to escape back to the mountains, back to the future for them. And that's the sort of context that I think is often missing, the geographical context from news.
Tim, let me ask you a bit about just writing books. I know you're quite a sort of prolific writer. Do you find that even just writing a book about, this is some pretty meaty topics to get stuck into, does it afford you an opportunity perhaps to, rather than scratching the surface, to really get into the heart of things and to get that context, to understand the history, where, as you rightly point out, a lot of the frenetic contemporary news media basically fears to tread?
They fear to tread because I think some people underestimate the audience. I mean, I think there's a real thirst for context. I think there's more of a thirst for context now than there perhaps has been. And yeah, a book does give you that opportunity. Look, it is not an academic book. I mean, I'm not sure I'm capable of writing an academic book. It is, and this is not snobbery, it is middle brow. Which is pretty much where I am. There's even the odd joke in there. For example, if Putin says he believes in God, in which case he must get down on his knees every night and say, God, why didn't you put some mountains in Ukraine? because it's flat land, he has got fewer choices than he might want. Because if you put some mountains there, you've got some defence. He hasn't got any defence. So instead, they try to defend in Poland.
And do you think that while the news media might ignore geography or not understand it too well, when it comes to political leaders and military leaders, they understand it very well?
Absolutely. All political leaders, all serious historians understand geography. Look, I don't want to overestimate how much news media ignores. I mean, the newspapers do occasionally on the big pullouts, they'll do a map in a side column to give you that context. So do the graphics in some of the TV news reports. But, fundamentally, it's not front and centre. And I think it should be one of the things that's front and centre. But yeah, the geostrategists, the people in the defence ministries, they know their geography inside out, and they also project ahead 20, 30, even 40, 50 years. And a lot of the stuff they project is based on geography and technology. These are people that go into it really, really deeply.
So let me ask you about some of the specific sort of maps. You've got the classic sort of plates here in the book. How difficult is it to settle upon the received wisdom? Did you find, even as you're putting it together, that there were contrary, conflicting recommendations, you can take the Times World Atlas view, but do reflect this? And I don't know, even as the book was being put together, they say, you better change this because that's slightly, were you chasing your tail almost a little bit at times?
No, because I know what you're getting at, because it is difficult and there are different maps. But I just thought, I don't want to get bogged down in this. And I took an early decision. We're going to call that bit Israel. We're going to call that bit Palestine, which, of course, is contentious. I particularly like the map we're using of the Arctic, because the classic British and, to a lesser extent, European view is to look at the Arctic at the top of the map. The way we've done it is to look at it from top down. I think it's a fascinating look at the Arctic that makes you understand it better, because you're looking at it from a bird's eye view down. There's so many things we could say about the different maps, but they are the classic, based on the classic Mercator map, which is what most of us know. I personally like, there's an alternative map that actually tries not to do that squeezing of space.
Is it the Peters projection?
I think it might be. And the map of Africa, for example, you suddenly realise how long, incredibly large and relatively thin it is. And then also you start to realise that Kazakhstan is as big as the entire of Western Europe. But if you look at the Mercator map, Western Europe and Kazakhstan are not the same size. Greenland, absolutely huge place. It's a sort of like relatively small island on the Mercator map. And they know why they're doing it. They're doing it because you can't put a round thing on a flat surface.
Let's move away from maps for a moment. As we said in the introduction, you've travelled quite broadly over the last 20 years or so. You've covered a lot of different conflicts, a lot of different changing political situations. When you look at the state of TV news, something that you've sort of semi-stepped away from now, how do you see where television news is now compared to, say, two decades before? Is it in a better place or a worse place or somewhere in between?
It's in a different place. I remember when I first went into TV, late 80s, and there was these old duffers, somewhat like myself. Oh, you've missed the glory years. When it was magic, oh, no. And then I had glory years. They were absolutely fantastic, still are. And I have been saying to the younger journalists, you now have the glory years. Because it's a great job. It's fantastic to work in. It is different. Then, I mean, when I first came in, you'd hear these stories about guys that trek across Africa for 2 or 3 days, put something on film, send it back on a camel on somebody's in a film can, fly it over, and about 8 days later, it was on the news that night. Whereas, of course, now we just go live. And it's been quite a journey along that 30 years. But that must have been fantastic fun. But taking out a small satellite in the middle of a conflict zone, well, I'm not saying it's fun, but relatively fun, that's also, you know, it's an amazing thing to be able to do. So I think they're both good, and I think they're all the golden age.
Why do you think then people are always having this conversation? Is it just it's a necessary part of, you know, the way the human mind is? You always look back through the classic rose-tinted spectacles. Or do you think that there are changes, there are threats, there are pressures, be they commercial or editorial, you know, make it a justified question to ask?
Well, yeah, no, it is justified. The latter point I agree with. The former, no. I mean, flippant comparison, the traffic in London now moves at approximately the same pace as it moved in the 1880s with the horse and carriages. You know, it's really not that bad. It's no worse than it was in the 1880s with the horse and carriages, and at least you don't have to sidestep all that stuff that comes out of them. Now you sidestep the exhaust fumes. On the second point, yes, there are commercial pressures. Yes, there's the pressure of speed. For example, in TV, years ago, we were taught, OK, guys, you're no longer TV journalists. You are journalists. You are multi-platform delivery journalists, which I hate the expression. But, you know, you've got to go and tweet. You have to file your blog. Can you please take a 360 photograph and stick it up on the website? Can you do the radio? Oh, and by the way, would you file a 3.5-minute TV piece for tonight and go live every hour? I don't think those pressures help. And they're trying to get round that by sending, say, two people, right, this is your priority and this is your priority. I do still think we are spreading things a little bit thin. And as I said, there is a thirst for context. But the 24-hour news channels, I know some people disparage them. I actually think you get quite a lot of info if you sit and watch that for an hour and 90 minutes.
Steve mentioned in the introduction that the what and the why, which is, as we described it, bringing clarity to the global news agenda. Some might say an easy or difficult task. What have you learned, I mean, since you've been doing that project, about how best to achieve that? Is it about resources? Is it about a more considered approach? Is it, I don't know, an attitudinal thing? What brings that kind of clarity?
Well, look, I don't really have a budget. You know, it's a website, and there's a few people I work with, and we put stuff up there. But it's context. You know, I've broken one story in the last 5 months since I've been running it. You know, we don't go out and report, but we analyse. It's mostly me analysing, hopefully bringing the experience to it. So, for example, I've got a piece up today talking about the extremes of Greek politics. And it is starting to bleed through now, this idea, oh, hang on, it's only a few years since there was a military dictatorship there. And it's only a few years before that, before there was a civil war. 1944, 45, 46, there was a civil war in Greece. It's not that long ago. And I'm not trying to scaremonger and say, oh, that's where they're heading. But I have put a piece up saying, if this continues, if Europe does not help, if the divides in Greek society, which are absolutely there, which were covered up in the last few years, they start to divide, it will head in that direction. You will see Golden Dawn growing, and you will see the extreme left growing. They are both putting the cloak of nationalism around them. So the piece is contextual, saying, look, this is where they have come from. Or I might do another piece and then do a sidebar in it with just the basic facts and figures. This is how many people live there. This is the capital city. This is how many people live in the capital city. Because if you don't know that stuff, a lot of it's sort of nebulous. You need something to hang the facts on, and that is a structure.
Who are you reading and watching and listening to these days?
There's this fellow called Steve Bloomfield, right?
Oh, God, not him.
But in terms of, whether it's, through traditional media, New York Times or BBC or so on, or people that we're perhaps less aware of, where are the places that you go to get your news, your context, your analysis?
Well, there's lots, so I'll just try to remember a few. For example, the Long War Journal. It's a terrific website with some really classy writing and people who know what's going on in the sort of fight against Islamism, but also the conflicts on the ground in places like Afghanistan. The Long War Journal is pretty good. I think Strategic Forecasting, Stratfor, it's a subscription website. I think they're pretty good at what they do. I mean, of course, I go through the daily newspapers, and I can read a bit of French, and I look at the French press, and I look at the English translations of other things. But it's less and less, to be honest with you, mainstream media. It is more and more experts and things like the Long War Journal. Well, even Chatham House and RUSI, these are two British think tanks. If you go to there, you see these in-depth articles. Personally, I think sometimes they go on and on, and they're written in an academic
they're
manner.
They're academics. They're,
it really doesn't
who
help.
Need editors, yeah.
Yeah. But you pull stuff out of there, real class act research, and then you try to turn it into English.
And what about sort of, citizen journalism? Because, again, a lot of people say this is the future, and other people say without editors, this is nothing. The power of anyone to pick up a pen. A lot of people say, well, it's truly democratic. What could be better than that?
I don't believe in the phrase. I understand it. There are people that do their utmost to behave like a proper journalist, not behave like a journalist who taps phones, but a proper journalist. But I don't believe in the concept of citizen journalism because 99 times out of 100, it is, I hate that politician, I'm going to rant about them. Or, I think the police are brutal, therefore I'm going to go and write something about the police being brutal, as opposed to going, having a look, getting evidence, collecting, sifting, having a second pair of eyes on it. A lot of it's just ranting. And there'll be citizen journalists who might be shouting at the radio or the computer saying that's disparaging. I don't disparage what they're doing. I just don't think it should be called journalism because I don't think it is journalism.
Tim Marshall, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. The book is called Prisoners of Geography, and it's out right now. And that's that for the Monocle Weekly. Tom, we had a Stephen, another Stephen, a Tim.
I'm a Tom. There's another Tom behind the glass.
I'm a Steve.
There's all sorts happening.
I think we're more interested in this than
most people not that bothered about that. But what they will be interested in is what a great show that was. We talked about maps. We had underground farming. Who knew that's going on virtually beneath our feet?
Indeed.
And all points in between as well.
And indeed, a fascinating discussion with Stephen Witt about music.
Super interesting. And actually, the book... of course, the story of the piracy and this change to the business is fascinating, but the actual, sort of alluded to this, the pen portraits he draws of some of these players are very, very colourful. Well worth reading.
And if you don't want to read it, I mean, I suggest you do read it anyway, but we hear you might be able to wait for a film.
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows indeed?
It'll certainly make for good viewing.
It would kind of, in a weird way. You wouldn't think that these sorts of things about coding and so on would necessarily make for good films. But The Social Network turned into a great film.
It proved it.
So there we are. I think that is just about it. Rob and Andrew will be back from New York and somewhere in the countryside.
Somewhere sunny, I imagine.
I think.
And hope, for Andrew's sake.
Yeah. Next week, they will be in these chairs. Tom, you'll be... Now, here's the big question for next week. Danny had his pink Cadillac of news. What sort of motor will you be rocking up in?
I'll probably be on foot, because with my news hounding. I go over there on all fours. That's an image to take away for your Sunday afternoon.
There we are. Have a wonderful Sunday, wherever you are in the world. Try not to think of Tom on all fours. The Weekly was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Bill Luthi and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager, as ever, was Claire Urban. The Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.